Senate Judiciary will come to order. Today is 20 minutes till 2. We have three members here. We have quorum Huggins, Wilikowski, and Senator Terrio. And we have three bills with us today. It's the intention, unless we stumble across something we don't like, to move forward CS for House Bill 7, Finance. And the other two will hear and hold over. So with that, let's take a look at House Bill number 7. And Dirk, would you come forward for us and refresh our memory? I know there was a question on the physical note, and if you would talk us through that very quickly.
I believe there was, through the chair, I believe there was a mistake that was caught by Senator Terrio, where it was a Class B when it should have been a Class A misdemeanor.
And Senator Terrio, have you had a chance to look at this?
I'm just looking. So here's the news.
Indeterminate.
Yeah, I see it has been corrected. So thank you.
Okay. Are there other modifications or things that have come to mind that for one reason or another the committee has not addressed that we should be aware of at a minimum?
Through the chair, no.
Okay. Are there... I'm sorry, Dirk, identify yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Dirk Moffitt, staff of Representative Bob Lynn.
Thank you very much. And let the record show that Senator McGuire has joined us about 30 seconds after we started. So with that, Senator McGuire, we're looking at CS for House Bill number 7.
Okay.
We've looked at the physical note, appears to be in order, and Senator Terrio has reviewed it. He's the one that pointed out the discrepancies. And we have three bills. We're looking at moving this one forward today, and we're at the juncture of seeing if anybody has any objections or concerns at this point they want to address. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick question.
Senatorial.
So I'm looking at the one fiscal note that I had was Department of Law, Civil, Commercial, and Fair Business. This new fiscal note that I have is public safety. So, I mean, there's a bunch of different fiscal notes in here for the agencies. Did we get a new one for Department of Law?
I have not had a new one come in to them yet, but I'll make sure that it backs up.
Okay.
Bill goes to finance.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions or comments? Will of the committee? Senator Wilikowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd make a motion that we move the CS for House Bill number 7 onto the next committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, are there objections? Okay, hearing none, CS for House Bill number 7 will be moving forward, / Victor, individual recommendation, attached fiscal note, and understanding that the law piece has to be developed to be brought forward going to finance. Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Dirk. Next, we have Senate Bill number 247, an act relating to missing persons and unidentified human remains. And Darwin, please, if you will come forward, put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Darwin Peterson. I'm staff to the Senate Finance Committee, but this bill was drafted during the interim by Senator Green, and at the time I was her staff. So I appreciate your indulgence, Mr. Chairman. Senator Green has asked that I introduce the bill today. I'm also joined by Dirk Kraft from the Senator's office, and he'll be picking up the slack on this bill as it moves along the process. But for today, I'll be introducing it and answering questions. The language found in this bill was born in August of 2005 as model legislation drafted by the U.S. Department of Justice. It was a result of the President's DNA initiative, which brought together various law enforcement agencies, medical examiners, forensic scientists, victims advocates, and policymakers. Their charge was to help federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies to fully utilize the potential that new DNA technology has to solve crimes and protect the innocent and identify missing persons. In response to their charge of improving the process for finding missing persons, they recommend that the states adopt some version of this model state legislation. Senator Green was made aware of the need for this legislation here in Alaska through one of her constituents, Ms. Mary Weir. Ms. Weir shared with us her story of her daughter Samantha, who went missing for 19 months. It's a very moving story, and I don't want to get too deep into it because hopefully she may be joining us today online, and I'd like her to share her story with you. But it was because of Ms. Weir's advocacy on behalf of all the missing persons that Senator Green decided to introduce this bill. Before I go into the specifics of the bill, I think it's important to say that Senator Green believes that the law enforcement agency does a great job in Alaska. They do great work with the resources that we give them. But as you heard during Judiciary Committee's Crime Summit, the system moves as fast as its slowest part. And if you read the analysis in the Department of Public Safety's fiscal note, they state that there are currently no consistent standards or protocol for the content, timing, and method of submission of missing person reports amongst law enforcement agencies. So Senator Green feels that if we can increase cooperation among law enforcement agencies and improve their ability to locate and safely return missing persons, this is a very worthwhile effort. The Department of Public Safety has been very, very helpful in this process. I met with them at the beginning of the session, and we ironed out some of the problems in the bill right away. So already this bill is a better version than what we originally drafted. We are committed to continue working with law enforcement in Alaska to make this a good bill, and rather than tell them what to do, we want to give them what they need. With that, I'd like to just give you a few bullets on the specifics of this bill. It will prohibit the disposal of unidentified human remains unless DNA samples are archived first, prohibits law enforcement agencies from refusing to accept a missing persons report, provides a detailed list of specific information to be gathered and recorded by law enforcement about a missing person. It allows law enforcement to obtain a DNA sample from the family of a missing person who has been missing for more than 30 days and then forward that DNA on to an approved facility for analysis and dissemination.
Excuse me there. Where's that provision? You said from a family member, right?
Yeah. On page 4, it starts on line 6, it states that if the person is missing for more than 30 days, then law enforcement shall attempt to obtain DNA samples from family members and from the missing person along with any needed documentation, including any consent forms required for the use of state or federal DNA databases. So that that DNA would not be used to match the person for any other potential crimes. It would be used to help locate the missing person. If there's a missing person who is lost in another state and unidentified, and the DNA from that person's family member was obtained and loaded into the database, then immediately they would find the match and they would be able to identify that missing person, even if the missing person is already deceased.
So that's at the discretion of the family member, not mandatory.
Mr. Chairman, I have to check with Ledge Legal on that. The way I read it, the law enforcement agency shall attempt to obtain DNA samples from family members. I don't read anywhere here in the bill that says that it's at the discretion. That might be a very worthwhile amendment to consider, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, that you asked a question I was going to ask, and I also wanted to know how you define family members. Is there definition in there? Is it people that live in your household? Is it brothers, sisters, uncles? I'd be curious as to how that's defined. And we don't need it right now, but at some point.
Okay. Through the chair, thank you, Senator Wilkowski. We'll talk to the drafter about that, and if family members is defined, we'll get you a definition of that, and if it's not, then we'll propose some language to define that.
Okay. Good. Please continue.
Furthermore, this legislation requires all missing person reports to be entered into the National Crime Information Center missing person file, the unidentified person file, and then our own state crime information system. And finally, it provides a mechanism for law enforcement to determine if a missing person is deemed high risk, and if so, take immediate action. Coming to the realization that a loved one is missing must be a very difficult thing for a family to endure, and going to law enforcement and filing a report is the first step. So we believe that if we can help improve that process to increase the success rate for identifying and finding missing persons and returning them to their loved ones, it's a very worthwhile effort. That concludes my testimony. I'm happy to answer questions. I appreciate your time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Wilkowski.
When law enforcement is page two, I'm looking at version C. Is that the version you're working off of?
Charlie, correct.
Charlie. It says law enforcement agency shall gather following information, and it's got a comprehensive list. We're mandating that they gather this information, and so I guess what I'm curious about is how far does this go? Let's say you don't have someone's blood type. Does this give law enforcement the right to go and get medical records so they can figure that out? I guess I'm just wondering how far this is actually, what kind of onus this is going to put on law enforcement agencies. And maybe we need to hear from the law enforcement agencies on that, but or law.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that working with the Department of Public Safety and drafting this bill, that is a concern of theirs, and I'm sure you'll hear that from them. If you change the word shall to may, you'll probably zero out the fiscal notes, and but then the legislation would be
doesn't have
any teeth then. So there, it does go quite a ways, and as I mentioned, this is based on the model legislation that was drafted by the U.S. Department of Justice. So as we go through this process in this committee and in future committees, we'll fine-tune this list. Those that are too onerous or too expensive may have to fall off, and we may find some other things that are also important to gather that law enforcement should be looking at. And law enforcement has been very, very cooperative, and they, you know, they said that they pretty much gather all this information anyway. And if we're going too far and violating people's, you know, rights to privacy, then that definitely should be taken into consideration.
I just happened to have the SME, as in Kathy Monfredo, on the line. So, Kathy, are you there? Ms. Monfredo?
Yes, sir.
Yes, it's Charlie Huggins here. Could you put yourself on the record, and did you hear Senator Wilkowski's question?
Yes. For the record, my name is Catherine Monfreda. I am the Chief of the Criminal Records and Identification Bureau for the Department of Public Safety in the Division of Statewide Services. Senator, through the chair, Senator Huggins, maybe you want to repeat the question.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. Well, I was just curious what your position was. That there's a requirement that law enforcement agencies shall gather when you're preparing this report, and I think a lot of these are obviously very important, probably things you're collecting now, but when you start talking about things like blood types and social security numbers and maybe things that might not readily be available or that people may not necessarily want to release, do you have any thoughts on that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not with the Division of Alaska State Troopers, however, I am responsible for the NCIC and APPS and entry portion of missing persons, and it is true that most of these items on the list are already requested either through Alaska requirements or the NCIC requirements. I'd have to go through one by one to validate and see if there's any that are impossible. I'm not sure what would happen if the information wasn't available.
Well, Ms. Monfredi, are you concerned about the extensiveness of the list? On page?
Through the chair, no, not particularly.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And I think possibly somebody from AST might be more able to speak on that topic. However, I believe that, like I said, that most of these items are already being collected as part of a normal missing person report.
Okay. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Through the chair, and I guess to Darwin, it's going to take some time to go through the list, but one of them that just pops out right away is page 2, line 27, the name and location of the missing person's dentist and primary care physician. That's probably a HIPAA violation. I mean, my suspicion is that there are other laws that supersede the privacy related to that. I couldn't give out your your physician's name, for example, nor could your physician confirm that you were a patient. So there's just a couple of those. We'll just have to, I get the point. I think it's a good, I like the philosophical basis of the bill. I just think what we want to be careful if we're going to have a shall, and we might want to even, if we're going to have a shall, we need to be sure that law enforcement can actually accomplish these goals. We might want to have some language that gives them an out, like something like make reasonable efforts except where prohibited by law, laws that supersede, or something like this. I'll play around with it, but we certainly wouldn't want law enforcement in the position of violating law in an effort to try and help us locate missing persons.
Yep. Ms. Monfredo, Charlie Huggins again. The list on page 2 and goes over to the following page. My assumption is that your subject matter experts, when they're working through, and people that work these kind of cases probably have a more extensive list than what's here, or some additional things. Is that true or false?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I believe that's probably true. I think that in most cases, the person reporting a loved one missing is wanting to provide as much information as possible in every attempt to help to locate that person.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator Wilkowski had another question.
No, Senator McGuire.
Senator Terrio?
I agree, you know, when the language says the law enforcement agency shall gather at the time of the report, so it's a family member or somebody that's concerned that's making that report, they went to the law enforcement. So I'm not sure, Senator McGuire, do you think there would be a HIPAA violation? If I'm reporting that my mother is missing, I know that her primary physician is, you know, Dr. X, giving that information wouldn't be a violation, would it?
Through the chair, I don't think your giving it would be the violation, but the confirmation and the actual medical records being released from the physician would be. So, you know, it's a lot like me saying, well, I think he was wearing a green jacket. I mean, I guess you could report that. But I would suspect for the information to be meaningful, you would want to confirm that it's not just your poor recollection or guess as to what the primary care physician was. In an effort to confirm that, law enforcement would bump up against HIPAA because they're not allowed to confirm or deny without the patient's express consent. So that's all I guess I mean. And then if you get down to the blood typing and so forth, any of that information, obviously, unless the family member happened to have a copy of it, which I think is pretty rare.
Yeah. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. What happens to this data? Is this entered into a computer somewhere? I would have some concerns over privacy. You're getting someone's credit card numbers, their social security numbers, a lot of personal information. Is this centered somewhere where the public has access to it, or is this kept confidential? Do you know, or maybe DPS if they know?
So the chair, yeah, I would ask Ms. Monfredo to answer that question if she can. And also for the committee's information, Lieutenant Dial, who is the Department of Public Safety person that I was working with, along with Lauren Rice, in drafting the bill, he is here today and is supposed to be here to help answer questions. He can answer a lot of these questions, but I think he's downstairs in House Judiciary in the omnibus crime bill. So he's supposed to be here shortly. So if he does show up, just for your information, he can help with a lot of those questions.
Okay. Senator Terrio?
Thanks. On page 2, line 16, it says driver's license, social security number, and credit card. Credit card number is not part of the Model Act. I'm wondering why you added that.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, it wasn't at our request. The drafter added that. So I think it was his poetic license. But you know, if it's something that the committee disagrees with, we wouldn't have any problem with taking credit card number out.
Yeah, well, and I can certainly appreciate that law enforcement now tracks people with credit card numbers. You know, mm-hmm. if you're looking for somebody, that the charges are almost immediate. I go down and charge groceries at the store here, and my wife, when I talked to her in the evening, she said, oh, you went to the store today, huh?
Yeah.
You know, if she happened to be paying the bill, she can see exactly where I went that day.
Yeah.
So it's almost immediate. I'm wondering, I guess the question I would have for the drafters, no bank accounts, or, you know, to see if if the missing person is drawing money out mm-hmm. of their using their ATM Wells Fargo ATM card in Washington or wherever. Just one thing to point out. If the determination is that we want to add things beyond the model, maybe we want to consider that also. Also on page 1, line 9 and 10, you say the law enforcement agency has to take the report if they believe with reason to believe the missing person is in the jurisdiction served. And I'm just wondering, what if I think that, you know, my cousin has gone missing, but I think he might have, you know, fled the state. What if I think they're outside of the local trooper detachment in Fairbanks? And are they going to be able to say, well, if you think he went to Anchorage, then we're not going to take the report here in Fairbanks?
Through the chair, my understanding is that the Fairbanks law enforcement agencies will be required to accept the report. If you go to Fairbanks and say, I think my brother's missing, but I don't know where he is, I believe he may be in Anchorage, they would take the report and then enter it into the state crime system. If you have reason to believe that he's in Anchorage because, say his girlfriend lives there or some other compelling factors that you are aware of that make you believe that he's in Anchorage, then if you contacted the Anchorage Police Department and they were convinced that there's reason to believe that your brother is in the jurisdiction of the Anchorage Police Department, then they would accept the report.
Okay. And how about the missing person? Do they have to be an Alaska citizen? Or?
It's my understanding that no, they don't. If they're a Hawaii resident and they came to Alaska, similar situation, there's reason to believe that they're in Alaska because a spouse or a family member is here, then the local police department would have to take the report.
Okay, and then if I can, Mr. Chairman, a couple other questions. Page 3, line 16, it talks about the date of last contact, and I'm wondering if we don't want more than just the date of the last contact, maybe the time of day, the place, details. Was it, you know, the scene of a fight, or you just, you know, kissed him goodbye at the bus station? Or so that's just a question there.
Thank you, Mr. Terry, Senator Terry.
Darwin, you mentioned that you had multiple people to testify. Whom do you anticipate?
Mr. Chairman, the only person that we requested from the district to testify was Ms. Weir.
Okay.
She was the impetus behind the bill, and we did not receive confirmation for her that she was going to be able to call in today.
So,
so we don't know. But that and Lieutenant Dial, if he was here, but he's obviously still downstairs.
Other Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, one question. I don't know if you can answer this or not, Darwin. I would be curious to know. How many reports the police get of missing persons? Is this is that something that they? I mean, are we going to overburden the police if someone's missing for an hour? And I know the police kind of have a policy that they wait for 24 hours or so. I'm not saying that's the right policy. In fact, it's probably the wrong one in a lot of cases. But I'd just be interested in hearing their perspective on if this is going to create some kind of undue burden for them.
The number that sticks in my head is 5,000. Oh, 1,500. Just off by a little bit.
At five.
1,500.
1,500 reports is how many they take per year.
They take, and yeah. Do you know how many they refuse to take? Or no?
I don't know. Lieutenant Dial would be able to answer that question if he were here. I apologize.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Is there a current? Do they have a current policy that you have to wait 24 hours or something?
They don't have a policy per se, is my understanding. It's kind of up to the discretion of the police officer. That's my understanding, but Lieutenant Dial could give you more specifics maybe at the next hearing if he isn't able to make it today.
Yeah. Senator Terrio.
On page 4, line 9, talks about the DNA samples from a family member. My wife and I think we've set aside some of our children's hair or something like that, you know, in case they ever came up missing. How would that DNA information be handled and ultimately disposed? I mean, we've got systems where people who commit crimes, have to give up their identification markers, and it's logged into a system. if I voluntarily give this on my children because they're missing and found out, you know, it was just miscommunication, how's the system going to release of or dispose of that information ultimately?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, that's a very good point. I'd be happy to work with your staff in coming up with language on ways to dispose of the DNA once the missing person is located. I recall in legislation in years past that we've done just that, and that wasn't part of the model legislation. But I think it's a very good point that should be included.
Okay, and then on page 5, line 17, we're talking about a high risk missing person, and one of the determinations is that the person is missing more than 30 days. That seems like a long time.
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, it is. That's kind of the bar that they set as one of the factors for deeming a person a high risk. You know, they don't want to say 2 days because law enforcement really can't be going out and treating someone like a high risk missing person just because they've been missing for a few days. It would be nice if we had the resources to do that on every report, but so they. You know, the model legislation just picked a block of time that if they haven't been found in 30 days, then we really consider them to be high risk. And that's just one factor. There are a lot of other factors that also, you know, if they're abducted by a stranger, obviously they're high risk, and that would be immediate. You wouldn't have to wait 30 days if they were abducted by a stranger or abducted under suspicious circumstances. Any of the other categories could also trigger a high risk category. But 30 days, if the committee believes that should be dropped down to 20 or move that date around, we'd be happy to address that, entertain that idea.
Okay, and then the final thing that I had flagged was on page 6, line 13, missing person report protocols. We're telling law enforcement agencies, well, we're encouraging them to establish written protocols, and it seems like, you know, wouldn't we require them to actually take that step?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, we certainly could. We certainly could say that law enforcement agencies shall establish written protocols. I guess maybe this language came from the fact that a large part of the protocol is right here in this legislation, but they should also have that. That's one of the problems that DPS currently acknowledges, that they don't have written protocols specific as this, so yeah. Putting the word "shall" in there is also something definitely that we would entertain.
Yeah, since this
Senator
is
Bulikowski, and we have Lieutenant Dial on the line, so Lieutenant Dial, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Would you put yourself on the record, and we're going to refer some questions to you, and exercise initiative if you hear a question you have the answer to.
Yes, sir. For the record, my name is Rodney Dial, D-I-A-L. I'm a lieutenant with the Alaska State Troopers stationed in Ketchikan.
Okay. Lieutenant Wilkowski. Go ahead. Or Lieutenant Wilkowski.
He's got a promotion.
Or colonel or general.
Oh, boy.
Just a comment on page 6, lines 6 and 7. Where there's a statement that says Alaska State Troopers shall notify officers to be on the lookout for the missing person or suspected abductor. Just something to think about. This potentially puts the state at risk of lawsuit if this notice is not done and something happens to the person. The state's potentially at a risk of a very large lawsuit. So it's something to all in our heads.
Okay, Darwin, any question, or Senator Terrio?
Maybe Mr. Dial can chime in on page 6 there, the discussion we're having about law enforcement agencies, whether they're encouraged to establish written protocols or actually required by state statute to. If, in fact, this bill is basically a template for the protocol, whether he thinks there would be a problem with actually requiring that the law enforcement officers across or departments across the state do it so that there's some uniformity in the way that the system is working.
Yeah. Lieutenant Dial, did you hear the question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We generally support the goal of the legislation. We do have some concerns with some of the requirements of the bill. We would prefer that they be may do versus shall do. We do have some liability concerns as well. Generally speaking, of those 25 requirements, we do almost all of those all the time anyway. There are times, though, that we might not ask, for example, if a child had cosmetic implants or something of that nature. And our concern would be with some of the shalls in the legislation. We think it can be a good template and still have the maze in there, but still give some of the discretion to the individual agency and officer.
Don't understand. I would just commend to you that those people that fly up 747s, 757s have a checklist that is very rigid, and you have to go through every one of them. And my assumption is this task is one that probably exceeds some of their tasks. But in any event, it's a good point, and we'll consider that.
Lieutenant Dial, the info that you gather, is that logged in a database or is that kept confidential? Is it destroyed after a case is solved or after a period of time?
Through the chair, is it Senator Lefkoski?
Yes.
The information that the officer receives is entered into a report. That report is within 48 hours sent to the Missing Persons Clearinghouse, which is a division of the Department of Public Safety. And that information is kept essentially forever until the person is either found or remains are found. And at that point, the information, whatever we have, is disposed of.
And if I might, Lieutenant Dial, I think you're referring on page 4 to line 22 through 26. Is that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually referring to our current policy. If you're referring to the bill and the requirement that we would collect either DNA samples or obtain releases from medical records or medical records themselves, that information would be destroyed one way or another upon completion of the investigation.
Okay, thank you. Did he answer your question?
He did. I guess just one follow-up. Do a large number of people have access to that information?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, they do not. We can make that available to other law enforcement agencies if that would help in the location of the individual, but generally that information is kept confidential.
Thank you.
Darwin, are there other questions that you want to refer to Lieutenant Dial that was asked previously that you were taking notes on?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant Dial, I believe it was Senator Wilkowski had some questions about how many reports we take. I made you guys a lot more busier than you already are, but 1,500 was the number that we used, and Senator Wilkowski also had some questions about how many of those are solved, outstanding, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, through the chair, we receive somewhere in the neighborhood of 1,200 to 1,500 missing person cases per year that come into the department's Missing Persons Clearinghouse. Of those, the vast majority are found within about 48 hours. We do maintain that information indefinitely until the person is recovered or remains are found, and we currently have about 1,000 open cases.
And if I follow up on that, do you have some sort of policy? I've heard that departments require like a 24-hour waiting period if the person is an adult and there's no suspicious. Do you have anything like that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, we do not. We immediately take the report.
Okay, Darwin, any other comments that we need to be aware of at this point in time?
The only thing I would like to mention, it reminded me when Lieutenant Dial said that there are currently 1,000 cases now open. Language that's in this legislation that's not consistent with the model state legislation is in the applicability section 4 on page 6, that this legislation, if it were to pass, applies to reports and investigations of missing persons that are reported after the effective date of this act. So it was a big concern to law enforcement if they had to go back and do all this work for the 1,000 cases that are currently still open, and we understand that. It would be nice if we had the resources to do that, but we understand that that's outside the realm of possibility. So just for the committee's information, as a policy discussion, we decided to make this effective to only missing person cases that are filed after the effective date.
Yeah, very good. Ms. Monfreda and Lieutenant Dial, do you have any summary comments or thoughts that you need to share with us?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, this is Lieutenant Dial. I do not. As I said before, though, we do support the goal of this legislation, just hope that we maybe can have some input into making it as best as possible.
Right. We're going to hold the bill over, and we'll have further testimony on the elements. And, of course, you'll have the same opportunity. Ms. Monfreda?
Mr. Chairman, no, sir. I have no further comments.
Okay. Thank you very much. We will set this bill aside till at least the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You missed the quiz. Whether or not... Come back to order Senate Bill 226, an act relating to litigation brought by a vexatious litigant. And I'm not going to read anymore. And for the record, Senator McGuire clarified her understanding. She looked it up, too, after hearing it. So, very good. With that, if you would put yourself on the record and bring us up to date on this.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Cindy Smith. I'm staff to Senator French. Senate Bill 226 creates a process and statute for courts to manage the problem of lawsuits brought by individuals who are vexatious litigants. And a vexatious litigant is defined in this statute and in statutes like it around the country as a person who, among other things, repeatedly litigates the same claims or previous adverse decisions against the same party. They file multiple lawsuits or frivolous lawsuits, and frivolous is a legal meaning of without legal merit. It doesn't mean you might have a bad case. It means you basically have no legal case. Repeatedly files pleadings or motions that are in bad faith, engages in tactics that are without merit or cause unnecessary delay. These laws exist in California, Hawaii, Ohio, Texas, and Florida presently. And the point is just to allow the court a mechanism to impose some reasonable restrictions on vexatious litigants' access to court. We don't have hundreds of people, as far as we know, doing this. We do have a few. Mm-hmm. And they take up an unreasonable amount of court time. And in some cases, as I think you'll hear from the Department of Law, the Department of Law's time as well. When the conduct is aimed at private parties, it also means often that party has to go out and hire an attorney to represent them, even though there's no case, in order to make sure that that things are handled and disposed of properly. So it's a sort of an undue burden that we'd like to give the court a tool and at their discretion to use. It is discretionary. The court may do this. And there's a standard in the bill. It's on page 3 that defines what a vexatious litigant is. Number 3 starting on line 12 through D. It looks like at the end of line 31, so at the end of that page. I'm going to defer questions about some of the mechanics of this in court to Mr. Ford, who is here with the Department of Law, and I believe Mr. Mawson is online as well to testify.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski.
Does this apply only to people who initiate lawsuits? I know, at least I've heard stories about people who've bought lawsuits against the same defendants over and over again, and the defendants fight the case tooth and nail right to the end, and then they lose. But the person forced to bring the lawsuit is still out the money and the time that they've expended to do that. And so has there been any thought about that?
I'm going to defer to the Department of Law on that.
Or do we have no vexatious defendants?
Yeah, thank you.
(Clears throat) For the record, my name is Mike Ford. I'm legislative liaison for the Department of Law, and through the chair to Senator Walikowski. I think if you look at the definition of a vexatious litigant, commenced, prosecuted, or maintained as the plaintiff, at least five. So I think that the concept here is to, at least under A, is that you are the plaintiff and not the defendant. Although there are, under the other paragraphs here, repeatedly litigated or attempting to litigate, so that provision may apply to a defendant. And then the C and the D provisions could also apply to a defendant.
Okay. How much of a problem is this in the state? Is it a big problem, little problem?
Well, Senator Huggins, I think as you heard, no, it's not the number of people who are doing this, but the significantly small number of people who absorb an enormous amount of resources from the court system and from other people who are trying to use the court system for justice.
Right.
So no, I mean, we're probably talking in percentage numbers of a very small percent.
Yeah, but it doesn't take many people to
no. To
be effective. In that sense, If I'm a vexatious litigant and I have a lawyer, does that vaccinate me from this bill? Because that's what it says without.
Well, Senator Huggins, that is the intent of the bill, is that it seems the individuals who are causing this problem act as their own attorney. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do have an attorney, we have other tools to deal with that situation.
Okay.
If you are an attorney who is pursuing a case that has no merit, that violates some other provisions, and there are other tools to deal with that problem.
Yeah, and my final question for you is, would this deal with liens as an example? Would it be the same sort of thing or not? That people, and I say that because I remember the first thing that I worked on here that I didn't understand and somebody dropped on my desk was Liz Penn's, and because of what was happening with the Fish and Game Board mm-hmm. business and you know, was taken care of, but I'm just wondering if this would apply to those kinds of things.
I think that is an example of one that could be abused.
Right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator Terrio?
Is this specifically targeted at the jailhouse litigants?
Through the chair, Senator Terrio, we have other provisions that deal with jailhouse people. There are provisions currently in law. I think the legislature passed those not too long ago that deal with jailhouse lawyers and require certain provisions that apply to that type of litigation.
Okay, so this, and I thought I remembered the debate at least happening before. I couldn't remember the outcome. So does this, does it mirror what we did for in those cases, or it's just, does it mirror it, but it's in a separate section of the statutes to apply? So
through the chair, it is similar in the sense that it is intended to control a certain specific kind of litigation. So in that sense, it does mirror it, yes.
Okay. And so those folks that are incarcerated, they will still be handled under that old other section of?
Correct.
Okay. Yeah.
This through the chair, this is civil litigation.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
Right. Yeah. Other things, Mr. Ford, that think would be germane for us to be aware of at this time. We're going to hold the bill over, so Senator French will be back in the chairmanship here.
Senator Huggins, I just wanted to point out that although this is a concern for the Department of Law, this is also a concern for the private sector. Mm-hmm. And I think that you will hear from testimony online today that is a concern that also would tend to, you know, to see this bill move forward.
Okay, good, good. And Senator Walikowski?
Any issues, constitutional issues, right to trial impeded by this? Have there been any challenges in other states?
I don't believe there are, although I have attached an ALR article that discusses a number of those issues. So far there has not been any successful challenge that I'm aware of.
Okay. Senator Terrio?
Looking at the fiscal note from the Department of Law, it says the bill would amend current statute, the Alaska Rules of Civil Procedure, and the Constitution of the State of Alaska. Of course, this bill can't amend the state Constitution of Alaska. So what are they talking about?
Through the chair, I'd have to look at that fiscal note. I don't believe that we are amending the Constitution here. I think we should probably correct that.
Staffer will take care of that for
yes.
us. So, yes.
That would be a first.
Yep. Okay. Let's go online to Mr. Peter Mawson. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes, Mr. Mawson, would you put yourself on the record, and we would be glad to hear from you.
All right. Thank you. My name is Peter Mawson. Last name is M-A-A-S-S-E-N. I'm testifying on behalf of myself as an individual, and I'm testifying in favor of SB 226. I guess I should say that once I put the speakerphone off of mute, I can hardly hear what's coming in the other side, so I hope you bear with me if I'm not responsive. I'm an attorney with a small private law firm here in Anchorage, and I've been practicing law for 27 years here. During that time, I've encountered very few litigants whom I would say are vexatious litigants, and I want to make it clear from the outset that I would be very suspicious under most circumstances of any attempts to put restrictions on people's access to the courthouse, because, of course, it's a very important safety valve for people who otherwise would resort to self-help or would have no recourse to any help at all in suits that have merit, who have real problems that need to be dealt with in this way. But there are some limits to what the participants in the judicial process need to put up with, and it's not just the judiciary and the Department of Law, but also private litigants and private attorneys like myself. And I think that's where SB 226 comes into play and can provide a very good tool for the judiciary. I've been litigating with one man, Dan DiNardo, since the summer of 2002. His landlord tried to evict him in that year, and he brought a suit against the landlord, and I was asked by State Farm Insurance Company to represent him in that suit, which is what I basically do. It's a lot of my practice. A year later, Mr. DiNardo sued me and my law firm and Judge Gleason for allegedly conspiring together and to deny him discovery. That suit delayed resolution of the underlying suit for a year while it was resolved because Judge Gleason didn't want to proceed while she was being sued by Mr. DiNardo. The landlord-tenant dispute was ultimately resolved. The suit against me was ultimately resolved, but Mr. DiNardo brought another four suits against my clients, the landlords. He brought another three or four suits, depending on how you count, against me and my law firm. He brought lawsuits against three of the judges who were involved in those suits, Judge Tan, Judge Ridner, and Judge Gleason. And every one of them resulted in a decision against him, but every one of them required me and my firm or State Farm on behalf of their insureds or somebody to spend the time and the money and the resources to put together a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment, which isn't necessarily an easy process and which takes time. I've gotten a number of judgments against Mr. DiNardo, needless to say. I've gotten judgments for attorney's fees based on the fact that he's litigated vexatiously. I've gotten discovery sanctions against him, which he has never paid, and there is basically nothing in the way of a monetary sanction or a judgment which can deter him from doing this. It's what I do for a living, so I can't get too upset about it, but it has had an impact on my personal life as well. When my wife and I wanted to buy property and start building a new home in Anchorage, we went to the bank to get a construction loan, and of course the bank wants to know if there are any lawsuits pending against you. And of course I had to tell them that there were several lawsuits pending against me, and the claimant was seeking $5 million in damages in each one of them. This took a little bit of explaining. Of course, the bank understands that these things happen. But it's something that the litigants in ordinary litigation shouldn't have to deal with in perpetuity, which is how this has turned out with this particular litigant. It's been over 5 years of litigating basically the same claims over and over again. I think it's fair to say that some people whom you would classify as vexatious litigants are mentally ill. I'm speaking solely as a layman, of course, and we have to feel sorry for them and find some way to deal with them. But dealing with them, allowing them to vent in this way through the court system at the expense of private parties, private litigants and their attorneys, is not the way to do it. And I think that SB 226 is a very good tool for the judges to use in disposing of cases like this. And that concludes my testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Mawson. Questions or comments on Mr. Mawson's testimony? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Mr. Mawson. And we'll next go to Mr. Jed Whitaker. Can you hear me, Mr. Whitaker?
Yes.
Yes, it's Charlie Huggins here. Would you put yourself on the record, and we'd be proud to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Jed Whitaker. I'm a resident of Anchorage. I'm going to speak against Senate Bill 226. I think that we are all supposed to, under the Constitution, have equal protection under the law. That means that whether you have money or don't have money, you should have equal access to the courts. There may be a few individuals who cause problems, but I do believe that judges have the right to dismiss frivolous lawsuits and to create legislation which addresses a problem which judges can solve simply by dismissing lawsuits only makes the government bigger and denies equal protection under the law. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Whitaker. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Terrio.
I'm wondering how you would suggest that we deal with this situation. You can say, well, regardless of whether a person has money, they're supposed to have access to the courthouse, and I understand that and am guarded of a person's having access. But what about the situation where the person really has no money, therefore is judgment-proof, they bring litigation, it's found to be frivolous, there's resulting court fees and attorney fees that are charged to them, they don't really care because they don't have two nickels to rub together. So how do we deal with that aspect of the, you know, equality in the system?
Mr. Whitaker, did you hear the question from Senator Terrio?
Yes, I did. I guess the question was addressed to me. If I were a member of the legislature, I would seek the advice of the Alaska Supreme Court to see if this is truly a problem. I don't think there are very many people who have the capacity, first of all, to engage in litigation on a pro se basis. You're talking about a very, very small, limited number of people. And I think, you know, just because somebody doesn't have money, and as Senator Thoreau points out, is to use his words, judgment proof, does not prohibit a judge from doing their job, nipping in the bud and granting motions to dismiss. I mean, the court system is not perfect, but judges should be exercising their discretion as necessary.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Whitaker. And that's a fair question. What, Mr. Ford, what do you reckon?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Ford again. Those are very good points. We do not want to limit access to the courts, except in a very surgically precise way. As I mentioned earlier, we are not talking about very many people here. We're not talking about an obstacle to the courts that will affect a lot of people. It's just a very, very few people. So in that sense, I do not think we're creating an impediment to the court system. What we're actually doing is trying to address an issue that arises in very, very few cases, but those very few cases have an impact far beyond their own litigation sphere. The question about what the judges can do, Judges have a lot of authority, but to dismiss a case, that's kind of the nuclear option. It's very rarely used. In fact, I don't know of any cases where it's ever been used.
Senator McGuire.
Yeah, and through the chair, and Mike, this is just something to consider as the Department of Law. I agree with you, but I do think it's a travesty. Both Rule 11 and, you know, the good faith basis that you're supposed to have in filing a case and the motion to dismiss, that judicial power, those should be safeguards in the process. And I concur with you that they're not. I think that there's a tendency on the part of lawyers to advocate for their client no matter how unreasonable the position may be. There might be some, you know, scintilla of evidence or basis. And then, of course, there's the ability to collect fees. I mean, let's be reasonable. I'm not impugning people's character. I'm just saying that's the system. And then on the part of judges, I think it is, you know, there's a real fear that dismissing it, there could be something there. And I would just encourage the Department of Law. I think this is one good step, but perhaps communication with the bar and the rules of the court, it's something to think about, whether that language should be more clearly defined in terms of the motion to dismiss and in Rule 11, to make it clear that the judge should be a gatekeeper. And I've seen cases where I think, how is that not just dismissed outright? And you know what's going on in the judge's mind. They're thinking, well, you got to give it some opportunity. And $10,000 later, whoever's in that position and having to respond, because most people will hire an attorney. And by the time you're through that process, you know, just even to get it, you know, to a settlement point. And I think that there are people out there that intentionally abuse the process for settlement purposes. And I think you're seeing more and more of that, where people know that if they can file a claim, a judge isn't going to dismiss it. There's some attorney out there that will take it. And you've now got to respond as a business owner or whatever, in whatever context. And it's going to cost you, you know, $10,000 to $20,000 to settle, to give that person the check that they want and to walk away. And I just think it's a travesty. There are so many merit-based cases, but these few cases, they cost people. And as the lawyer was speaking earlier, I was thinking about that. Tremendous cost on people's personal life, their energy, the amount of time that they have to give to their family and other things, the financial resources. It's just a tremendous drain. So I would just encourage the Department of Law and Cindy, you know, that as you take this issue on, that you kind of look at it, you know, as a triangle, that there's something we can do in the legislature, there's something that might be done by the bar with respect to its own canons and its own rules of the court, and really emphasizing that role of a judge as a gatekeeper, and finally, the ethics of the lawyer themselves, and really sitting down and considering, you know, is this client setting out for a settlement? Are they setting out on something that really isn't merit-based and could be settled another way? And to really ask themselves through those canons and those ethics whether this is the kind of case that's appropriate, irrespective of the money that's paid in fees.
Yeah, and I would just underline and concur with, I don't know what Rule 11 is, to be quite frank, but under the definition, the fact that we have without the assistance of an attorney, and your response was, well, we have a way to deal with that. I mean, that's why we have the judge, too, I suppose, in concurring with what was said previously.
Mr. Chairman, I think what we're trying to do there is simply narrow the scope of the bill. We're aware that there's a delicate balance between access to the courts and yet managing this problem as well. So in response to that, we're trying to make this as narrowly focused as possible. So those cases that are brought without the assistance of attorney, but which also meet this other criteria, are the cases we're talking about. And those are, again, very, very few.
Right.
One advantage of a bill like this, as opposed to relying on an individual judge, is it does give you one additional tool that will be consistent across the state. It's not something that's going to be interpreted, you know, something discretionary
yeah.
by each judge, yes.
Senator Wilkowski.
This doesn't apply to workers' comp cases, I would presume.
No.
And if I could, Mr. Chair, just I guess to give my comment on it, I think there probably is. This is obviously a concern. You know, the access to courts is an important issue. The rich obviously can do it. The poor, if they lose, they're judgment proof. The access to the courts issue in Alaska, I think, is an issue that has a real impact on the middle class. Yeah. And when I talk to friends and people who have been damaged, that's their redress. If they're not getting redress from the legislature or from the governor, that's where they go. That's where you have the David of Goliath standoff. And they're on equal footing with the multi-billion-dollar corporation. They're same footing. The concern that I have and that I've seen is people saying, I'm afraid to bring a lawsuit because if I bring that lawsuit, and it's a perfectly valid lawsuit, they're going to drag me, the plaintiff, through tens of thousands of dollars of discovery. I may have a perfectly valid claim, but if I lose that case, I'm going to have to pay their attorney's fees. And so I'm worried about not only this issue, but also about defendants who work the system in a way that they just fight everything. And the reality is, you know, maybe they lose 5-10 cases in a row and they end up paying someone $50,000 apiece. That's nothing for a huge, huge corporation with billions of dollars. So I think there, when we're putting this together, that there needs to be some thought given to how this is going to really impact the majority of people in Alaska, really the middle class, and their access to lawsuits and their access to a judicial system that is really stacked against them.
Very good. Well, all good comments. To be held over till next meeting. Are there any other comments or questions from committee members? Okay, thank you, Mr. Ford.
Thank you.
We're done. Thank you. Oh.